You are listening to Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. It is just past 8:35 on this Wednesday morning. And we continue our collaboration with the Conference on World Affairs. It's happening all week on the CU Boulder campus. This morning, we're hosting a live panel discussion on tiny homes and livable cities. I have two guests in the studio with me, and I would like to give a shout out to Andrew Heben. Andrew has a background in urban planning and also has been involved in the tiny homes movement as a solution to homelessness, particularly in Eugene, Oregon. But he was unable to join us this morning. But instead, we do have our scheduled panelist Liz Blake joining us this morning. Thank you very much for coming in, because you have a background in Habitat for Humanity as a former senior vice president and a huge background in the particular topic that we're going to be talking about. So thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Well, I very much appreciate Richard Foy for joining us at the very last minute. Richard is well known in Boulder as founding partner for Communication Arts and also as designer of the Pearl Street Mall. And Richard, I know you have a much broader background in that, particularly as it pertains to urban planning and the conversation that we're going to be having this morning.
Right. Do you want me to go into that?
Please give us a little bit more details.
All right. So I came to Boulder in 1971, and I had been formerly an art director for the office of Charles and Ray Eames in Venice, California. And I studied design and graduated from California State University at Long Beach in the honors program in design. And my firm was fortunate enough to design the Pearl Street Mall, which sort of triggered a lot of developers from all over the world that came and looked at this project and said they liked what happened here, not necessarily to do another mall, because we never did another downtown mall. But we were responsible for the design of some maybe 300-400 million square feet of projects all over the world, in some very notable projects that were the catalysts for their cities, like Madison Square Garden, New York City, the O2 Dome in London, Greenwich, actually, and Berlin, LA Live Staples Center, and lots of urban centers and projects. So not specifically in housing, but as chairperson of Downtown Boulder for a number of times, most recently, I came off the chair position this year, and we were very much involved working with all the municipal agencies on homelessness and watching the culture of Boulder become more elitist, exclusive, and expensive. So housing is a factor in the overall context of a dynamics of a livable city, and I was the chairperson, the moderator for Liz's panel on making livable cities. So I did learn a lot from Andrew, and I can represent his viewpoints, and then I'll tell you when they switch over to mine.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And of course, Pearl Street, in many ways, although it was never really the center of the homelessness debate, in many ways it really is ground zero, because that's where a lot of people who are unhoused tend to congregate. And it's a very visible reminder that we are in an expensive city where a lot of people can't afford to have housing. So for better or for worse, Pearl Street has become part of the homelessness conversation. But before we kind of get into what makes a livable city, well, all of that, when Pearl Street Mall was being designed and the discussions that were happening, not just in Boulder, but in all the other cities that you mentioned, was there a new wave of urbanism happening? Was there new conversations happening about what makes a city work for everybody in the city? I mean, what was leading to all of that? To have an area where no cars were allowed and let's just make this somewhere where people can walk and have flowers and nice stores.
Right. But there's a lot of topics you just covered. I'll try and be brief. People like to gravitate to places that are desirable and comfortable and beautiful. And Boulder is all of those things. Boulder occupies the top 10 lists of some 30 or 40 lists, often number one. It is the smartest city in the United States, the healthiest city in the United States, the slimmest city in the United States, the city that has the best bodies that are wrapped in the worst clothes, made that list too. And but everybody wants to be here, including people who are impoverished. And because it's a climate that's welcoming, it's easier to be homeless in Boulder during the right months. It does get cold here. So, but livable cities and what makes people come to places is it's a complex thing. Jobs, beauty, meaning, and purpose, and connection. And so downtown is a place where all the homeless like to come, and urbanism is on the rise, and Liz probably has more data on that, because as I understand it, some 60% of the world's population is moving to urban areas, and that has to do with population. It has to do with women who are no longer tying themselves to vassals of the land and producing children that need to till the land. So we've moved from that agro-industrial to urban things, and women don't want to have more than one child, and all of the European populations are not reproducing at a rate that's maintaining their population. So immigration and workers are needed. So lots of issues there that you touched on.
Well, we'll touch on many of those, I'm sure, in our panel. But I'd like to thank Richard Foy for joining us this morning. And I'll move on to Liz Blake. And for many, many years, you were involved in housing issues as the former senior vice president for Habitat for Humanity International. Richard brought up the fact that there is this mass global migration towards cities. And I think, was it last year that we finally had a tipping point? More people live in urban areas than in rural areas. But what has all of that meant for housing?
That's exactly right. I think it was 4 years ago that the tipping point turned globally. And what it means is that cities are desirable, which is why people are choosing to be there. But unfortunately, the tipping point has come without urban planning in almost all of the areas. It's a fabulous thing if you go to any city that's vibrant and exciting, but the underbelly of that city often shows the fact that there are not adequate resources in the city for the additional populations that come. Often the migrations come as a result of natural disasters or other refugee situations. And trying to take from this global migration to cities, which by the end of the century, 85% of the world will live in cities. So just to give you the rate of trend, so from 51 to 85% in a relatively short period of time in mankind's, there needs to be a planning for a livable city that really isn't underway. I love the idea that CWA had livable cities, and you all have taken up livable cities as a topic because it needs to be an area of focus. And I think Richard did a great job of defining livable cities. The Economist and Mercer and Monocle and other organizations actually track livable cities data. They track data on crime and safety. They track it on connectivity these days, which is terribly important.
And that's like public transit and how easy it is to get around.
And internet.
Oh, internet as
well. And internet. Because public transport is a separate category in those studies. They have data that they collect on tolerance and public attitudes. They have wonderful data that they collect on architecture and recreation and public transit and business conditions and policies. What is not tracked enough is what the impact of this urbanization is on vulnerable populations.
And I wanted to ask to that end, is affordability part of that as well is being tracked? How people, who gets to live in the cities? And when we talk about how a city is livable, who is it livable for? Because some people are barely surviving.
Exactly. It's interesting. In the major studies, they do have living conditions that are tracked in the NumBeo study. And this is a fabulous survey that's actually done by data input from the users themselves in the field. But The Economist, their three criteria are availability of goods and services, low personal risk, and effective infrastructure. So that isn't anything per se about housing. Mercer has safety, education, hygiene, culture, environment, recreation, economic stability, public transport, and access to goods and services. But again, part of the problem is even the surveys that are tracking the data related to livable cities are not making the focus and that needs to be on housing and affordability, because it's not necessarily seen as livable cities for all, but livable cities at some higher ranking level.
Well, affordability of housing was your interest for many, many years as this former senior vice president for Habitat for Humanity International. A lot of people are familiar with Habitat for Humanity, and obviously the name of the organization says it all. But remind our listeners a little bit about how it's operating globally and what impact it's having on this housing issue.
Thank you. Habitat is the 10th largest home builder in the U.S. and has added programs of advocacy and repairs and renovations. So it's actually meeting a broad spectrum of housing solutions needs. Outside the U.S., it is in 72 countries, and it works to engage communities and have communities engage on their own behalf to solve their own living conditions problems. And living conditions include water and sanitation and adequate space and secure tenure and access to livelihoods, as well as the physical structure that's so important. In the U.S., Habitat's in all 50 states in more than 1,500 communities. And importantly, for the listeners who don't know it well, Habitat doesn't give housing away. And we actually are kind of against giveaways and donations because that's really not a sustainable model for anything. We actually believe that you have to work and partner with families, accompany them, have them put in the sweat equity, and build alongside neighbors as with volunteers to keep the cost of the product that you're creating affordable permanently. But then the homeowner has a mortgage. And it's often 20 to 30 years for that homeowner, often a single mother with multiple children, that pays back that mortgage.
And who holds the note, as it were?
Habitat. Habitat. And at the end of it, that family, the cycle of poverty, is permanently broken. And the family, often a woman with children, has an asset that provides her resilience against all economic strains and allows the children to go on to college.
I think that's a very important point that we don't often talk about, how the fact that property ownership is a way to break a cycle of poverty in families and also to build assets in low-income communities, where often we look at housing as just getting people off the streets in somewhere livable, but we don't look at necessarily the intergenerational component of that and what it really means for an entire community. There are some Habitat for Humanity homes in my neighbourhood in Longwood, and they're gorgeous. They're, you know, who designs them? I mean, this is really a whole movement that has been created around this. And as we're talking about livable cities, we're also talking about tiny homes. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Who is designing the homes? Are they, you know, obviously they're created to really blend into neighbourhoods, but is there any kind of an embrace of this tiny homes movement that we're seeing?
Well, Habitat homes are small, but they are not within the tiny homes movement per se that we're talking about. I like to think of housing as a continuum, and communities need to have everything from the emergency shelter that enables a homeless person to get off the street all the way up to through rental, through stable rental, and through rental that can then lead to enough savings that people can actually afford to get to home ownership, which does provide the topic against, does provide the barrier against real risks. But I think your point about housing is to look at it as a health vaccine because it keeps kids safe. It's resilience against poverty. It stops almost completely gender violence, or it enables a reduction in gender violence. And then the other thing is housing enables children to stay in the same school, whereas in poverty situations, children are often in a different school 3 to 4 times a year and 5 to 8 times during a high school sequence. And it's impossible to get educational attainment if you have unstable housing.
And if that of course perpetuates the cycle of poverty.
Exactly.
Well, that's Liz Blake, who's a former senior vice president for Habitat for Humanity International, one of the panelists joining us on KGNU this morning as part of the Conference on World Affairs. We're hosting a panel, Tiny Homes and Livable Cities. We were to be joined also by Andrew Heben, who has a long background in urban planning, but particularly tiny homes and how that pertains to homelessness solutions. But instead, we're delighted to have Richard Foy join us, and he's well known in Boulder, designer of the Pearl Street Mall, founding partner of Communication Arts, very much involved in urban planning locally. Richard, do you want to weigh in on some of the points that we raised there?
I think it would be helpful for Liz to clarify. It seems as though Habitat for Humanity is working in a very effective and noble way, providing homes for people in need of homes. But I don't think that's the same as homelessness in the urban context. And that's a different issue, which is very much on top of mind in Boulder. So,
yeah, I'd love to clarify. Thank you, Richard. Okay. Habitat has a mission which is not focused on homelessness. There are other NGOs and there are public programs and there are amazing angels of mercy that on an individual basis rescue and deal with and support homeless people. That's not Habitat's mission. Habitat's focus is on taking home ownership as an opportunity, or reinforcing home ownership as an opportunity, because home ownership ends the cycle of poverty. When we get to talking about tiny houses, interestingly, the highest proportion of those houses are actually home ownership opportunities.
Right.
So tiny houses actually ties to the home ownership, and to some extent is a bridge between the homeless and home ownership, because tiny houses are potentially, if accepted by a community, much more affordable.
But we'll talk about tiny homes in just a moment, because that is something that is being put forward locally in Denver. The city of Denver just in the last couple of weeks issued a permit for a site that will build tiny homes with a view to getting people off the street. So that's very much pertaining to homelessness, and that's a transitionary model. It's not for permanent home ownership. And there has been a model put forward in Boulder as well, the New Chautauqua Project, which is also a suggestion of could we create tiny homes. And a lot of this is going to Andrew Heben's work, who couldn't be with us this morning, but he's involved with the Tiny Home Village in Eugene, Oregon. And I know the city of Boulder, city council members, city officials and interested parties went along a year or two ago to do a tour of Portland and Eugene, Oregon. And that was a big focal point of that. Richard, were you involved in that? Or
yes.
Do you remember the discussions that happened at that time?
That tour was organized by Downtown Boulder, and we invited city council to join us, and many of them did. And Portland was an eye-opener because, again, it's very important that we clarify the difference between people who have fallen on hard economic times or a woman with a family who doesn't have a mate and cannot cope with the cost of living. And I think that Habitat for Humanity and tiny homes, as Liz said, goes a long ways to solving the issues with that populace. But there's another populace, which is the people that do not want to participate in social programs. And Boulder has a very rich system that tries to get people repurposed jobs, provide social services, give them some health assistance. And that is another issue. And many people who are vagrants that travel through and like their urban nomad lives, who are attracted to Boulder. And recently, some of them started that fire here in Boulder a week or so ago.
Well, just to jump in, Richard, I wouldn't say that that's entirely representative of the entire homeless community.
No, I'm saying it is not. But there is an element that doesn't even want to go to homeless shelters because they don't want to give up their pets or their weapons or their lifestyle. They don't want to be part of that.
Families are split up because you can't have male and female partners together, husband and wife. So it's not always a clear-cutted choice, maybe, I think, is maybe you're presenting it.
Right. I agree. And so I am trying to make that distinction between homelessness and getting people into manageable lives and homes and other people which are a little bit more problematic. There's both of those.
Well, that actually does lend itself to, you know, a very important discussion, whether or not we'll get into it deeply in this context, that there are so many different aspects of homelessness. Right. There's people who can't afford to pay rent, who've lost their homes in the mortgage right. crisis. There are people for a variety of social reasons, whether it's addiction, mental health issues, domestic abuse, have ended up on the streets in that crisis situation. And so when we talk about livable cities, and we went through the various different outlines and I suppose definitions that different organisations have put, very often those very vulnerable populations are not represented. And so, Liz Blake, I mean, how do we move to a point where livable cities are livable for everyone and that we do have those vulnerable populations represented?
Well, I think there are a few key characteristics of the solutions, none of which is easy. And the first and most important is that any solution or any movement towards livable cities must be based on community engagement. And I don't mean a few community meetings. I mean really harnessing the multiple voices of the community so that the people who have very strong opinions as to what they need or what they desire or what they represent is actually included in the various solutions that are put together by the people that have the resources. So if you have meaningful engagement, you can bring about transformation. Probably the most exciting example I know of this is Medellin, Colombia. And I'm old enough that when I was in high school and college, Medellin was the most dangerous city in the world. It was the center of all drugs. Cocaine traffic was centered by Pablo Escobar, quite visibly holding the city of Medellin hostage. 25 years later, it is now a model city. It's one of the most exciting cities to which I've ever been, and they've solved their problems. But the core, if you read about and if you go to see and talk to the city fathers, the core of their solutions were based on what they called imagination sessions, where they actually met with the people who lived in the comunas, and that's the favelas of that area. They lived up top the hill. Sometimes cities have poor people down low. Sometimes it's high up. In the case of Medellin, it was high up. And they had imagination sessions with members of the comunas. One of the characteristics that they, one of the attributes that they learned was that the lives of the members of the comunas were defined by the fact that they would go down the hill for their jobs and they would get robbed by the gangs and the drug lords on the way down or when they got their paycheck on the way back up. And it was unsustainable to get out of poverty. What the city fathers did based upon these imagination sessions was put in a 356-foot escalator and cable cars so that literally the members of the comunas can work where the livelihoods are and jump over the gangs and get to their comunas at the top of the hill. That's a solution that you can't come to by having preconceived notions.
Well, I know, Richard, you have certainly advocated for creative thinking around all of these issues that we're facing. And I just want to remind our listeners that this is KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. It's a panel discussion on tiny homes and livable cities, part of the Conference on World Affairs. My guests today, I have Liz Blake, who's a former senior vice president with Habitat for Humanity International. Also joining us, Richard Foy, who's one of the designers of the Pearl Street Mall in Boulder, long involved in urban planning locally. He's also partner of Communication Arts and long been involved in these housing and planning issues. And Richard, you were one of the folks that went to the tiny homes in Eugene, Oregon. And that's part of the work of Andrew Heben, who was also supposed to join us today. When you went there and you saw that, did that spark ideas? Because there was a lot of discussion when the city leaders came back to say, is this something that we could implement here?
Let me clarify. Our invitation to City Council was to go to Portland and study the issues there. They went on to Eugene, a college town, and interacted with tiny homes. I stayed in Portland and dealt with issues there.
Separate part.
So, but back to Portland. Again, in this sort of complex algorithm that is involves any solution to deal with housing, especially for people in need, What we learned is that we asked the mayor, and they gave us, they were very generous with their time and heads of departments. And the mayor said, if you want to solve the problem of affordability, there's only one solution, and that is density. You cannot go out. You have to go up. And, of course, we've capped our town at 35 feet, which is part of the big problem that we're now – that's biting us in the butt. And so we don't have the density. And so anytime you want to get more people living on a small piece of land, there's a solution there, and people are willing to do that. Many people of my age who bought their homes – when they were in the low hundreds of thousands, are now sitting in $1-2 million homes, and they can't even afford the property taxes, and they may be empty nesters. So we have all this resource material, space, land, structures, but there's a solution there, and it's to go up, increase density. And let me add one more thing. I was on a panel years ago with one of the luminaries that built NCAR, Walter Orr Roberts, a physicist who was very committed to science and a livable city. And he said, when we were asked, what would you do to make Boulder continue its livability, its vibrancy? He said, the only solution, and this is like 30 years ago, he said, take certain areas of town and take them in about a two blocks by two blocks, a total of 4 blocks, and build 100 stories, go up 1,000 feet into the air, and then do the parking underground, do the retail first 2 levels, then offices, and then it's residences. And he said, think about it. Everyone would have the most colossal view, and then let the parks come in and fill in around these buildings. So it was a vision that that even he 30 years ago said the solution is higher density and going up, but not blocking all the views, not having it be Stalingrad. But we're getting Stalingrad now at 35 feet, and people hate these buildings because everyone builds out to the maximum capacity, and they build these walls instead of having an 8-story tower with open space next to it and so forth. So there are solutions, but we have to be adaptable, and we have to evolve, and we have to embrace change, and we cannot go back.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the D word. Density is a hot topic locally in Boulder, and in many ways it's a subject of massive debate between developers, between residents, people who have lived here for a long time, people who have newly moved in here. And it really does seem to be one of those big issues that is causing a lot of, as I said, debate. But in terms of the topic of the panel today, tiny homes.
Right. OK.
I'm from Ireland. I've lived in different European cities, and I still can't get over the size of the average American house. They are absolutely massive. And when we talk about tiny homes, what I consider a normal sized home is considered here a tiny home.
Right.
And so it seems like we need a fundamental reevaluating of how much space people need to live in, how many bathrooms a family needs. I mean, what are your thoughts just on that in terms of, and this was also a debate that happened locally several years ago about the McMansions buying small homes on a nice piece of land,
scraping
and putting up a big, big house. Right. Now, you could argue people are entitled to live in the size house that they want, but it does seem that we are living in a culture where bigger is better, and we live in these massive houses. Now, putting aside the environmental footprint of all of that, how do we change that mindset that we don't need to live in these huge, huge houses? Drive between Boulder and Denver, all of those suburbs that have emerged, they're huge, huge houses. So maybe instead of the density debate, should we be talking about
both?
Can we just have smaller homes?
Both.
I think I'm sorry that Andrew wasn't here because he's quite a visionary. And his life in evolution in the tiny homes movement, tiny houses movement, was going from tent cities to tiny homes. And I would recommend that people track down his writings. He wrote a book called Tent City Urbanism: From Self-Organized Camps to Tiny House Villages, and was published in 2014. But what I think we have to look at is a number of the factors that would propel it. First is the people of a certain age are moving into the city. There is a reurbanization in the United States that is taking place. The second is that 76% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. And so why is it that we wouldn't at least consider tiny homes? I'm 65, and many of the people who are my age and a few years older and younger are moving into apartments. And from the McMansions where they were living, they are moving into their version of urban tiny homes, which is, at first was startling to me because I still like to mow my yard, but that's euphemistically mow my yard. But the tiny home movement is pretty exciting. Interestingly, the data on it are that 68% of the people living in tiny homes have no mortgage. So what would it be like if people had no mortgage? And that's versus 29% of homeowners that have very significant mortgages. 55% of them are in a position to save more. So they are then in a position to change their life because they have resilience in the form of savings. Tiny homes range from 100 to 400 square feet, but on average, they're just under 200 square feet. And that is by contrast to the average, which is 2,100 square feet in the U.S. And I think that's a pretty conservative average. And the other data on that is that $23,000 is what it costs to build an average tiny home versus $272,000, which is the cost. These are national numbers on building a home that 2,100 feet, I mean, square feet. So I think this is a movement that needs to have serious debate, and I applaud you all and CWA for bringing the topic in. Notably, 40% of the people in tiny homes now are over 50 years of age.
Yeah.
So where is this propensity to live in massive homes coming from? Is it the developer? Is it planning issues? Is it the consumer? Richard Foy, and actually this is one of the things Andrew is very up on, so I'd encourage people to go to some of his panels because there are a lot of local regulations actually restricting the size of homes that you can have, meaning you have to build them bigger. So Richard Foy, what's going on development-wise, permit-wise? Why are we not seeing more of these small homes if there's obviously some type of an appetite for us?
It's amazing. Those numbers are fabulous and they're very real. They're very real here in Boulder. And, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright said a luxury once tasted becomes a necessity. And, you know, palaces were big, but the peasants lived in huts. And we came out of that mindset. And so everyone wanted to have their lawn. And, you know, Eisenhower built all the highways and suddenly the suburbs were opened up and people built subdivisions with lawns and bigger houses than they had in cities. And that sprawl created the America that we know now. And then from one suburb to the next, if that had, you know, an average home of 1,800 square feet or 2,000 square feet, the next one had 2,500 square feet and it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's just a slow accumulation of stuff. And we even started a whole major industry, the storage industry, which that's a bunker where you can take your old clothes, your old furniture, everything that you can't part with. And what they're really taking there is their memories. And we're all comforted by our memories. And we're a little bit fearful of the unknown, of the next step, of the future. And that's very much in Boulder here. So it's a social, mental, cultural affliction that we suffer. And when people relieve themselves of that mortgage and the extra bedrooms that they're not using and all of their old clothes that they don't wear anymore, it's hard to get rid of your memories, so you put it in storage. But when you do finally empty the storage thing, it's you feel lighter and you feel more purposeful. And so it's definitely the future. And in Boulder, as I said, we're trapped by these property values, and you don't need the house, and you don't need the front lawn, the back lawn, and the estate. And the more property you have, the more responsibility and the more resources you use. And then the other thing is the world ecology now, the cost of energy, and the shortage of available land, arable land. Climate change is changing weather patterns, and and farms are disappearing. And so it's really in our best interest to trust and become more current and to move ourselves in ways that are more sustainable. And in doing that, we make a more equitable world for everybody.
Well, what are some of the regulatory barriers? Because you've very much outlined the cultural, the social, the emotional barriers we have to living in smaller spaces. Right. But there are some regulatory barriers. And I'm not up on what's happening locally. But in terms of being able to build a house, you have to have a certain distance from another house that goes to density. But also you could maybe fit, and excuse me if I'm being naive here, but some of those large houses, could you not fit two or three smaller houses
you
in
could.
There? I know there are you some could. Regulations, though, that are preventing
builders
from doing that.
But then there's
that.
Limitations of how many unrelated people you can have on one piece of property. And there was a time, like before the World War II and after, where people could have boarding rooms. And so oftentimes a widower or a widow would rent rooms out to people who were coming in, who were just getting started in their community. And it was a source of income that could help pay for the mortgage, and you can't do that now. And even the boarding VRBO things, there's big argument because people don't like strangers coming into their neighborhood. So it's a protectionist attitude, and it's a regulatory attitude that inhibits evolving to get more density, more people on the same piece of property. And as I said earlier, even the height is a way of getting maximum utilization. If you can get to 10 stories, you can have completely sustainable buildings. They don't use any energy off the power grid. They recirculate their water for plants and so forth. And lots of things can be done, but our laws, our policy is rooted in populism. Populism is rooted in the past, and we need to become progressive again.
Well, you did touch on there the cooperative housing, and that's another hotly debated issue locally.
Right.
Now, there are moves now towards allowing some type of cooperative housing. But I have spoken to local housing advocates who are very much aware of the cost of housing. And they say, you know what, unless you have stricter regulations on co-ops, it's going to be subject to the same market forces that drive up the cost of property.
Right.
And so you're just going to see more expensive cooperative housing.
Right.
So how much a factor is that market costs are going to drive up the cost of tiny homes? Because they can be very beautiful looking too, and maybe they could be in a nice location, and maybe then they'll just get to be unaffordable as well. Do we need to have more regulation on the actual cost of housing, which is not always been popular here in the US, but is something that's quite common in some larger cities and certainly in Europe? Liz Blake, former Senior Vice President of Habitat for Humanity. Go ahead.
I think there needs to be intentionality in the regulations that are adopted relating to tiny homes, as well as addressing the urbanization trends that are making cities unlivable where we want them, in fact, to be livable. And there are three things that I'd like to suggest we focus on for a moment. One is the affordability component. So there can be regulated into any new development, including a tiny homes new development, a requirement of a certain proportion of it being affordable. The second is that there needs to be a focus on recognizing that people have a right to live within some reasonable distance of where they work, and where essentially public transit is either unaffordable or not available at all. It's important for a city to be intentional about planning for a certain number of affordable units to be included. We need also to have ownership of the fact that as a society, we have a federal standard for what low income level is low enough that someone is entitled to a housing voucher.
Right.
Which would enable them to live someplace decent. The housing voucher would go to a landlord or a private landlord or a public landlord. Unfortunately, 4 out of 5 people in the U.S., and that's true as well here in Boulder, who are entitled to those low-income housing vouchers don't get them. And it's because we put $42 billion as a society, as a global, as a national society, we put $42 billion into affordable housing, but we put $178 billion into a tax offset so that people who have a home can have a mortgage deduction. So what we've done as a society is taken $220 billion, but only $42 billion of it, 44, goes for the affordable element. So we as a society are actually paying for it, but $3 out of $4 that go towards affordable housing in the U.S. actually goes to people who make $100,000 or more in the form of a mortgage deduction. So there needs to be a policy reexamination that holds us accountable for the facts that exist today, which is we as a society don't fund affordable housing. And there are easy market mechanisms to do that.
Well, now with Ben Carson as the head of the HUD, I think his qualification was that he has lived in a house. Do you think any of this is going to change, certainly at a federal level?
I have federal worries that might echo others. But I do have one piece of good news that I think is coming out 20 minutes ago in Atlanta, which is there are intentional strategies. And in Atlanta, I'm working on a project called West Side Future Fund, which is to revitalize and accompany the residents of the west side of Atlanta where Martin Luther King Jr. grew up, but where 70% of the people have left, and it's 2 square miles of blight, and it's adjacent to a brand new shiny football stadium. And the community and the leaders of the city and the business leaders have come together to solve this with accompanying the community. And the community said to us, one of the things that we're worried about is for those few of us that have home ownership, that market forces will come in and we will not be able to afford our taxes. And the business leaders and the mayor put together what will be announced today, or I think has already been announced today, which is a fund, an anti-displacement tax fund, that any homeowner who is existing as a homeowner now in Atlanta, in this area, whose taxes go up as a result of this appreciation of the market, will have their excess taxes paid out of this fund. So there are solutions.
It seems though that they're happening locally and regionally, as opposed to
federally. Locally and regionally, and also in response to meaningful dialogue and urban planning. And of course, the meaningful dialogue needs to include the vulnerable populations, particularly youth, women, and the elderly.
That's Liz Blake, who's a former senior vice president of Habitat for Humanity International. Also joining us in the KGNU studio, Richard Foy, founding partner of Communication Arts, well known in Boulder as a designer of Pearl Street and long involved in urban planning and housing issues locally. We were to have had Andrew Heben join us on the panel. He's listed in the brochure. He wasn't available, but he has a background in tiny homes, and tiny homes and livable cities is a topic under discussion this morning. We have about 10 minutes left. I could invite a caller to call in. We could squeeze in one or two callers. And this has been discussed pretty extensively at this year's conference on world affairs. Richard, I know you've moderated a panel, Liz, you've been on panels. What are some of the other topics that are being discussed around this particular issue that we're seeing emerge from the conference? And particularly, Richard, with a view to maybe finding solutions that could be applied locally.
I'm not aware of how many topics dealt with homelessness or tiny homes. Did you look at the perspectives? I don't think there was much. Some of the other topics that definitely affect this subject are, there's a lot on innovation and what is innovation and how do we move forward? How do we evolve and adapt and discover new areas of expertise that help all issues? And so we do need that. And I love the term that Liz said, intentional strategies. Now, that's a nice way of saying vision. We need a vision that we all sign into, and we need to be more inclusive in our thinking. Richard Florida, who wrote his book, The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited, identified the number one city that survived the economic downturn as Boulder, Colorado. And these were a survey of all the cities in the United States only that not survived but prospered. And so, and his three criteria were education. We are the smartest city per capita, highest education level, advanced degrees, college degrees, high school degrees. And the other one was technology, how many new patents were issued, how many new business starts. And the third one, very noteworthy, is tolerance. How much diversity do you have in your community? How many people of different income groups, nationalities, sexual preference? The more you have means the more open you are as a society and the more welcoming and the richer your community becomes. So those were topics that were covered in to some degree.
I think Richard did a great job of summarizing. There were some housing security and other conference topics. But what I'm hoping and praying is that next year, CWA will be able to recruit Matthew Desmond as one of the speakers and panelists. His book called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. I think it was announced yesterday or the day before. Habitat had him come to speak to our global conference just a couple of weeks ago. And he is highly provocative in raising a question about whether housing, people are evicted from housing as a result of poverty, or whether evictions from housing cause poverty or exacerbate poverty. And he did a highly, thoroughly documented and highly provocative book that I would recommend, easily readable, called Evicted, that people should listen to or read. I love books on tapes, or read. If I could just do one quote from him, he said, "It's hard to argue that housing is not a fundamental human need. Decent, affordable housing should be a basic right for everybody in this country. The reason is simple. Without a stable shelter or a home, everything else falls apart."
Well, with those words of wisdom, we're going to go to the phones. We do have a couple of callers standing by. I'll invite our guests to pop on some headphones so you'll be able to hear from them. The number to call is 303-442-4242. You are tuned in to KGNU. It's a conference on world affairs panel discussion on tiny homes and livable cities. We'll go first to Mike in Denver. You're live on the air.
Oh, hi. Great discussion. I just had to comment on one of your panelists, Richard's allusion reference to some real well-known person about the going up instead of out, you know. You know, the problem with the tiny homes is the land. You have a great scarcity of land, and they're, you know, it's definitely better than maybe a McMansion or something so far as a society. But the up and then the idea of parks and views, it is the logical solution. I don't know about 100 stories, but I love Boulder and have been there many times over the last 39 years, and I wished I could have lived there at one point. At one point I could have. I never looked ahead enough to realize how expensive it would become. But anyway, the thing is that quote that your panelist just mentioned about without housing, everything else becomes impossible. I mean, that's just hitting the nail right on the head. But the tiny homes, as neat as they are, and they're charming and all that, it'd be a fun experiment, but the practical long-term thing is the land is eaten up. The land is the thing that's limited. If we were in Italy, where the land is owned, as I understand by a friend of mine whose sister lives there, the land is owned, the actual ground is owned by the government. You can have, so the land explosion in land prices or raw land speculation, it simply can't happen. So, and they're densely populated, so there's just many political solutions, and the thing that's going to always turn the tide against that are people like our current president, who have made fortunes in things that are not necessarily don't have the slightest interest in the equity of things. So, I'll get off the line now. Hey, great discussion.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you for your call. We have a few people standing by, but of course, the land costs, particularly in a place like Boulder, that obviously is a major factor. Richard Foy.
Yeah, it is. And land costs is driven by supply and demand. And that's why even your caller mentioned that if you can maximize the occupancy on the land, you can get to affordability. So it's a basic supply-demand equation that that we're all in agreement on.
Well, we're hitting all of the Front Range this morning. We're going to go next to Fort Collins and invite Christiane to the airwaves. Thank you for being with us. You're live on KGNU.
Oh, thank you so much, Maeve. This is an incredible discussion. I really appreciate you taking the time to delve into it. My question is about land as well. I have been living in Fort Collins, but I go to school in Lakewood. I have been a single mother on the brink of homelessness pretty much for my entire adult life. And I want to break that cycle of poverty. I want my son to be able to go to college. And I feel like I'm trying to acquire all the life skills needed to make that possible, including going to school for building. So I have building skills, and there's any number of shelters that I could build, a tiny home, a yurt. Right now we're living in a small bus in back of someone's house, but that's not going to really be conducive to the winter. But my hope is to somehow find access to a place to put a dwelling that I could build myself, because that's the only way I'm going to be able to stay here, to keep my son in his school, to stay in the community that I've been for 25 years. So do you have any suggestions for accessing land, and are there proposals for these villages? Are they springing up now, and how do people like myself say, hey, I'm somebody who could be part of a community like that, and I have a lot to add?
Christiane, what a great call. Richard, any suggestions? Christiane has the motivation, the skills, and the desire. She seems like such a perfect person for this, but how do we get her land? How do we get her on the next step?
Well, there is some movement in the issue of land. There are land trusts. There's community land trusts that they basically buy the land, and then they are able to take the cost of the land out of ownership or occupancy in a structure, and you're paying for the structure. So she who has some skills, this caller, would be much easier. So, quickly look up community land trusts and see in the area that she wants to live in, and see if there's some availability there that she can get closer to her dream of owning her own small home.
And I would also say that you sound like the perfect candidate to be a Habitat homeowner.
Yeah.
Habitat is alive and well throughout the state of Colorado and in Fort Collins. And what you need to do to be a successful partner family with Habitat is to have just your kind of motivation. And land is included in the project. You need to put in sweat equity, which is actually to do the building alongside. And you sound like a perfect Habitat homeowner. There are also other organizations, Rebuilding Together and whatnot, that help enable that kind of self-help. And I wish you Godspeed in this, because I'm excited
Liz,
by you.
Answer this question for her. Can it be done on a one-off homeowner, one home somewhere?
So, Christiane, are those resources that you've ever tried to access, or can we maybe, if you call back in maybe about 5 minutes, we'll see if we can maybe offline get you some resources locally?
That sounds great. Well, could you, the person who spoke about Habitat, could you speak about maybe the timeline that people are facing in this area, waiting lists and so forth?
I'm not familiar with this specific area. Normally, it's 6 to 8 months around the U.S. Some communities can get people in houses very quickly, and some it can be up to a year, but I just don't know what the timeline is here.
Christy, if you call back at this number in about 5 minutes, we'll try to connect with you offline and maybe get you some local resources. But thank you very much for calling in.
Wonderful. Thank you.
We have just a minute left. I would like to squeeze in a final caller, Evan, calling in from Boulder, because we're touching on, as I said, the full range of the KGNU broadband signal. Do you have a very brief question or comment this morning?
Yes. One, tiny homes are illegal in all zoning areas in Boulder. If they were legal, since they're 10 times smaller, we wouldn't have to go up 100 stories. The so-called dense developments in Boulder, for example, across the street from the municipal building and the library, are all luxury units, like 1,000 square feet apartments. And They're very tall because they're very big. If we make tiny homes legal, we can solve the problem. There are many reasons homeless don't want to go to the shelter. Women don't want to be sexually harassed. It's a reservoir of disease. It's very noisy, which many people can't deal with, especially veterans with PTSD. There are many, many reasons, and people are going to continue to not go to the shelter, which doesn't have enough beds for them anyway, and they need a place to sleep. And it is everyone who works for the homeless, with the homeless, who is homeless in Boulder, knows that it is downtown Boulder which has prevented for at least half a century there being a legal campground for transients and homeless who won't go to the shelter.
Okay.
And this would prevent a fire because it would be monitored and people would have an incentive to take care of things. Now homeless are hiding their fires under the trees, and no matter how many vigilantes are out there, you cannot look under every tree in open space.
Okay.
So downtown Boulder should get out of the way,
okay,
as they probably are with tiny homes.
Okay, Evan, thank you very much for your call. And actually, you bring up a good point, and another one to remember is the shelter is seasonal and it's about to close. So there will be no overnight housing options for homeless people locally. But we are going to have a full week looking at homelessness in the coming month here on KGNU, a whole series on all of these issues that actually have been brought up today. But the focus of today's panel has been tiny homes and livable cities. I'd like to thank both panellists, Liz Blake, who's the former Senior Vice President of Habitat for Humanity International. And thank you for stepping in at the last minute, Richard Foy, who is well known locally, has been involved in urban planning in Boulder as a designer of the Pearl Street Mall, founding partner of Communication Arts, involved with Downtown Boulder. And a big shout out to Andrew Heben, who was to have joined us, but he will be on other panels talking about his particular area of expertise, tiny homes, and how that can be a solution to homelessness. This has been a panel discussion as part of the Conference on World Affairs. Find out more of KGNU's panels happening in conjunction with the conference at news.kgnu.org. I've been your moderator this morning, Maeve Conran. Stay tuned for the Morning Sound Alternative.